At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode number 135. We got a good one for you this week. My guy Josh Fields is an elk hunting machine out in Montana. He's also the marketing and sales director for Rocky Mountain Hunting Calls. So we got to talk to him this week. We met him at the ATA show this year. Super cool dude. He was more than willing to come on the podcast and talk a little elk hunting. Of course, we got a little bit of his backstory, how he got to where he's at. He played professional baseball in the Chicago White Sox organization, made it all the way to the AAA level, and then ended up doing what he's doing now with Rocky Mountain Hunting Calls. So that was a cool story. And again, we got into a lot of elk hunting kind of tips and strategies as well, which was really cool. Some pretty like basic down and dirty stuff, but I thought it was really good. I've never hunted elk. I've done plenty of research, not plenty. I've done some research on it and everything, and I've obviously watched a ton of it, but I don't know that much about it. So I got to ask him some very basic questions, and I thought he had great answers to all of them. Overall, it was an awesome conversation, so I hope you guys enjoy this one, number 135. This is the Ridge Hunter Outdoors Podcast. All right, man. Well, let's go ahead and go all the way back then to the beginning of your hunting or outdoor career. Because the last guy we talked to from out here, we usually start like, who got you into hunting? And he went back to who got him in the outdoors. It was his grandpa, and they were running traps and stuff. So who got you kind of into either hunting or just the outdoors in general? And then when you did start hunting, or if it's one and the same, what did you start hunting? Like, what was your first animal that you were after?
Oh, that is a great question. So we say, I'll joke and try not to date myself here. So being from Montana and growing up here in Big Sky Country, it's a mecca for the outdoors. So very, very early age. I mean, I was out in the woods with my dad and my uncles, you know, before I could legally harvest a deer or an elk, which is 12 here in Montana. Now at the age of 10, we have an apprentice program where 10-year-olds can just hunt deer, which is pretty cool now. You know, ever since I was a tiny little guy, 5 years old, I've been stomping around running in the woods. And you know, a lot of that credit was to my dad, my uncles. And then I just continued to, from a young age, adapt and take it to the next level. I kind of got obsessed with it. And with that obsession, I also had a baseball career too. Same kind of thing, loved baseball and all that good stuff. My dad got me started. I was pretty serious about it all through high school, you know, real serious actually in the outdoors. And then, you know, I went off to college for baseball and a baseball scholarship to Arizona Mesa Community College there. And I remember having nightmares that I wasn't going to get to come home and hunt, but then I really did. But I ended up working it out with my coaches over there at the time in school. If I did my schoolwork early, then I'd get a 10-day window to get to come home and hunt. So that all worked out great. So I was bouncing back and forth from college and baseball to outdoors. And would have been, you know, for me, I didn't start really archery elk hunting, which is my number one passion. And you know, our bread and butter with Rocky Mountain Hunting Calls, you know, we're very well known for our elk calls and, you know, our products that we have out on the market there for that. I don't want to call it, it's truly an obsession. It's not a passion, right? It's elk hunting. And me and you talked a little bit about elk hunting before we got on here. Once you come out west and you do it, holy smokes, man. Yeah, you're going to be a dick. It's true. Yep. Everyone wants to elk hunt. Everyone wants to come out, the appeal of them. And being, you know, I'm not partial by no means. You can water hole them, you can tree stand them, you whatever. But you the experience of actually bugling in a bull elk is second to none in my mind. I mean, it truly makes the hair stand on the back of your neck. So when I got into archery hunting, pretty serious. A real good friend of mine, my first and one of my only hunting partners, and a local guy here by the name of Doug Meyer, started taking me out. This was at the kind of almost the tail end of my baseball career in the White Sox organization. I'd had shoulder surgery 05. So now I had some time to come home in September. And we started chasing elk together. And, you know, he was a really good external cow caller, didn't use diaphragms much, didn't really bugle much. And then it came around where, like, that addictive personality and the obsession, I met a guy by the name of Rocky Jacobson. And so Rocky Jacobson was the founder of Bugling Bowl's game calls back in 1994. Mm-hmm. And so for some reason he took a liking to me. You know, I wanted to learn everything I could from him. You know, he's a pioneer in the elk calling game call industry. And that's when I really started to cut my teeth here in the Northwest and do some damage and have some real success and start to make a name for myself as far as in the outdoor space and the elk hunting locally. Specifically, it's really tough here in Northwest Montana. It's deep and deep, not a lot of elk, a lot of predators. Mm-hmm. And if you know how to call, you're going to have a tough time harvesting one, let alone even finding one. Mm-hmm. So Rocky was a very big influence and helped me with the calling game. And I joke about, because, you know, we do the World Elk Calling Championships every year for Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. And I've done it for my 6 years now, and I've done everything except win it. I've taken a second, third, and fourth in the men's pro. And I just say that because for workshops and seminars, all that says is that I can teach you how to manipulate or read and make some quality elk sounds. Mm-hmm. Show calling and calling in the woods are actually very two different things. But and I say that because Rocky, he would not give me any more tips and tricks after I beat him in the World Elk Calling Championship. So, pretty good stuff. That's kind of how I got started into it, and it just continued to flourish and obsession. And I'm one of those people that, you know, if you're going to do something, jump all in and be the best that you can at it. And it just happened to be that things fell into place after my baseball career. I had a law enforcement career, and then Rocky Mountain Hunting Calls position opened up. And the door was open. It was one of those things where, man, you know, my degree was in business and marketing. And so I got to give it a shot. And so here I am. So I've been promotional staff at the Rocky Mountain Hunting Calls for, going on nearly 20 years now. And nice. Then full-time marketing sales director position for 3.
Cool. I mentioned before we got started, we might chase some rabbits. So The first one we're going to chase is this baseball thing, because you're the second baseball guy we've had on in a row. And funny enough, the last guy we talked to went to the same school that I did, which was crazy because he's 6 or 7 hours away from us, and I'm like an hour and a half from that school. But anyway, so you played community college ball, and then were you drafted out of there? Did you go to a 4-year school after that?
Yes. So run down here in Montana, we just recently got high school baseball in the last 2 years. So growing up here in Northwest Montana, I never had high school baseball. It was just summer and all-stars, and then I went into Legion. Mm-hmm. And played all three sports, football, basketball, and baseball, but truly loved baseball. I had an uncle that was very influential and playing wiffle ball with me in the yard all the time, and I just, like, obsessed about it. Mm-hmm. I'd be at grade school, and I'd look outside, and the clouds would be out there, and I'd pray that it wouldn't rain so we could play baseball that night.
Yep.
And so from there, I went to Legion. I had an opportunity to go to Mace Community College. Another very dear friend and coach, actually, we have a film elk hunt that we did last year where he killed a really, really nice 6-point bull.
Sweet.
And he's, I think, Julio's got to be, his name's Julio Delgado. And for the local people that hear this, or statewide, he's really well known. Mm-hmm. I don't know who. He had went to Mace Community College, so he made a phone call for me. I went over there, worked out, got caught on at Mace Community College, and 3 years later was drafted by the Chicago White Sox in 2001 in the 23rd round as a right-handed pitcher. So then I started my pro career for all the way up till 2009 when I finished there. So I always joke, I say this a lot, I did everything except make all the money, and I was a but it was a great ride, and I was very blessed to get that opportunity from that organization, being a small town Montana kid, you know, with a dream to play professional baseball. And I got to do it, even though I didn't get, you know, I got all the way to AAA and had some really great years and some good numbers. And I didn't get a pitch in the big leagues, but I got to experience a ton of really cool things. And I think that, you know, set the foundation for other things that I've been able to chase and try and accomplish in life. So that was my baseball career. Yeah, right-handed reliever.
I figured you probably pitched when you said shoulder surgery, but you were kind of hit the good White Sox years. It's too bad you weren't there now. You probably could have went up there left-handed and pitched for them.
A friend of mine who's a big Twinkies fan called me the other day, and he goes, "I bet you're glad you're not up on that team." And I said, "Drew, I said, you got it all wrong.
Do you know what league minimum is right now?"
I need to be there right now. It just happened. And yeah, I mean, you know your baseball, because yes, in 2005, when I'm in AAA and I'm dealing and I'm right on the edge of a September call up, right? Who's winning the World Series? Who wins the World Series? All of the years. I couldn't have been like on the Devil Rays or something.
Right, exactly.
And so for some wild, crazy reason, I mean, that's just how the cards played out. And so 2005, when I was doing really well in Charlotte in AAA in the White Sox, they had to go on and win the World Series. But I went down in the middle of August with shoulder and ended up having labrum surgery. You know, you can say woulda, shoulda, coulda, if I'd have known now what I need then, I could have hung on for a bit longer. Maybe not got cut on and all that, but yeah, you're right, buddy. I needed to be on that team this year.
Yeah, sure. Or even just if you could have made it one day up in September, you'd have got a ring, right?
Would
September call-ups get a ring?
I don't believe so. I you have to have so much service time.
Okay.
But more so too. You know, the difference, like I joke around, did everything except make all the money, right? I was at work for some of that bullpen. I had a lot of innings in those years because I had a late round pick. I had to prove myself every single day.
You couldn't be hurt.
Yeah. And if you're hurt, you're no good. I mean, it's just, you know, on the training table, you're not able to perform performance based. I joke about doing everything except make all the money. Big league rehab money to minor league rehab money, there's just a little bit of a difference. So.
Just a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're actually paying minor leaguers a little bit better money now, so you kind of missed that window too, huh?
Yep. Which I'm not one of the bitter guys. I'm happy.
Oh, for sure.
They get some housing paid for and all that good kind of stuff now. Because when I came up, you were getting your token, whatever level you were at, you know, $6,000-$8,000 a month, and that the whole nine yards.
Yep. Well, that's pretty cool. I didn't know that you played minor league ball, but that's pretty cool. Yeah.
And I was just happy, like I said, to have the opportunity. So,
That's pretty blessed to be able to do that. Our partners at Flambeau Outdoors have some of the best solutions in the industry for your decoy and storage needs. They're focused on innovation that matters, and they build their products to last. They're probably most known for their whitetail, waterfowl, and turkey decoys, and that's for good reason. They've got a lot of quality options at great price points in each category. The Boss Buck is a personal favorite of mine in their whitetail line, and I've been throwing their Stormfront mallards in front of duck blinds for years now. Don't sleep on their storage solutions either, though. Whether it's fishing tackle, firearms, ammo, or archery equipment, they've got you covered. They just stepped up their archery storage game, too, with the new Formula Bow Case. It might just be the best bow case on the market, and I'm really excited to use it this season and for years to come. Make the most of your time outdoors with Flambeau. Realism that gets results. We'll get back on track here. You graduated from college, you go play pro ball, and then you said you got really into archery hunting when you were in college, right?
Right after college. So
right
I was
after.
25, 26 years old. So pro ball, at the end of pro ball.
Okay.
You know, kind of ended my pro ball career. I really got into archery hunting. So, and it just, that was, you know, and I'd always had wanted to do it. It was one of those things, but I was, you know, I was a hardcore rifle hunter, loved the outdoors, loved all that. And just, you know, have the time to take up the archery hunting. And boy, once I did, oh man, then it's.
Yeah, that's a whole nother bug, right?
oh, it is my, you know, my wife, when I first met my wife at the tail end of my, pro career, she would think that all I would do is just work so I could hunt and fish, and not, you know, she still kind of thinks of that today.
With
my three beautiful kiddos and stuff. So that they kind of ruin most of my hunts, and it's not because I don't get to go. I get to go just plenty enough. It's because I miss them and I want to come home early or something, you know? So,
do you remember your first bow?
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
I do.
What was it?
It was an old PSE, like Mach 10.
Nice.
And if I tried to pull that one back today, I probably would have another shoulder. So,
Yep.
One I had.
It's crazy. I asked that to just about everybody we have on, and I bet, I'd have to go back and listen to be for sure, but I bet 75% of people's first bow was a PSE.
Pete Shipley.
Yep. Back in the day.
ATA, it's Archery Trade Association, you know, every year it's the biggest archery buying show there is. And Pete Shipley got one of the biggest awards this year, actually, at the banquet. So that was cool to see him get up there and be recognized for his accomplishments and what he's done in the industry. So that was pretty neat.
Yeah, he's had definitely a fine career within the archery space, to say the least.
Yep. Yes.
So
yep.
you got into archery hunting then after your pro career, and then you said you got into the calling circuit more recently than that, right?
So what it would have been one of the first. So how it kind of worked, it was kind of a flash in the pan. I mean, it was Rocky threw me into the fire because I'd always been promotional staff. Rocky and I would talk on the phone religiously. I'd see him at some shows. I started working some shows for him in between my regular job, which was in law enforcement. And one year he says, you can come to the World Upline Championships and then you're going to call. And I'm like, okay, I don't even remember really thinking too much. Okay, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know is once you are up on that stage, you know, because there's a pro and there's a men's, right?
Mm-hmm.
You get thrown right into the pros because I rep a call company. I'm like, oh, gee, thanks, Rocky.
Exactly.
So I get up there and somehow I get lucky. And the first year I ever did, I took third. I was like, whoa, you know. That was a big deal. I mean, you go to hear those guys. I mean, it's truly the best in the world. I mean, there are some amazing callers up there. And so the following year went back and snuck through again and ended up taking second, which, man, you're able to get on that final stage, which is super tough to do. You really want to win that thing because you don't know when you'll get back there.
Yeah.
So I took second after that. Then we had the COVID year off and then went back the following year and then took a fourth. And then this last year was just not my year and I got bounced out early. And that's just how good the competition is. So, mm-hmm. I got into at about, I think, 2018, 2019, which nice. I say, and I always say to elk workshops and in the tutorials and stuff we do, you do not have to be a world-class caller to harvest or even call elk at all. I mean, elk basic sounds and then timing is a lot. And there's a lot of really good stuff out there with, you know, even on with our YouTube and tutorials and all that good stuff out there. But the best is boots on the ground and experience in the field. That's how you truly, mm-hmm. in my opinion, in his philosophy that you really learn. So,
So that sounds a lot similar to some of the guys I've talked to and some of the guys I know that do like the turkey calling circuit out here. Is it a pretty tight knit group amongst the callers? Cause that's always something that the guys consistently say about the turkey calling groups is it's pretty tight knit. You see everybody kind of at the same shows. It's like, is it the same way?
Same deal. Everybody knows everybody. And for the most part, it's a lot of the same year after year after year. You'll have guys and gals in and out, you know, and change the stuff, but you're absolutely right. Yep. From the top to the bottom, you pretty much know everybody there and that is attending those calling competitions and that kind of stuff. So, it's spot on.
Yeah. I like what you're saying there too about you could, because even just from turkey hunting, and again, it's not, I'm not one of those people that says it's like the same or whatever. I get maybe a little bit of the similarity, right? Because it's call and listen and the response and the stalking or whatever, but completely different. We're talking about a 25-pound bird versus a 800-pound animal, right? But
yes.
From, because I just started turkey hunting like 3 years ago, and I had talked to all these guys that either did the turkey calling or had a lot of experience, obviously way more than I did, and I could take all that stuff to the woods the first time, but until you actually get out there and hear what a bird's doing and what you are supposed to sound like versus what you thought you sounded like when you were going in, it's so much different. Yeah. I can imagine that elk hunting is probably the same way.
Yeah, and so even listening to it, you know, on videos and all that kind of stuff, there's nothing like it when you're actually in the woods.
Right.
I'm always saying to myself is I do not feel like I sound as good when I'm videoing and all that as I do like when I'm in the woods or even the show calling. But that's where, you know, you have your peers that are telling, yeah, this is good and this too. I mean, and honestly, you know, if you're decent enough or not, really, you know.
Right.
Even in that turkey world, I think turkey calling is a whole another dynamic, the stuff that those guys and gals can do with those.
Oh man, yeah.
Because I'm like, I can make all the clucks and the purrs and do all, but I don't, that's not my forte. I hunt turkeys, I'm a turkey killer.
Right.
But those guys that, gals that live for it, that do the grand slams, that really get, holy smokes, there's some crazy, you know. So yeah, you get the fire hose too, and learning, and it's continuing to learn with turkey hunting. That's a whole nother world, but some similarities with calling them as far as elk and turkey, those guys and gals. And that's the one thing I differ from elk hunting and turkey hunting. You can have some similarities and compare just a tiny bit, but they are two different worlds. I mean, we're talking about an 800-pound snot breathing, grown in nasty bowl to a, like you said, 25-pound thunder chicken, which, they're both fun. They're both fun.
Yeah, no doubt. I would say also the turkeys, maybe slightly less barrier to entry, at the very least when it comes to fitness, because I know plenty of guys that get out there and kill turkeys that are not going out to the Rocky Mountains and killing elk. It just is not going to happen.
That's a good point. But then, I also like to say too, is so the better, you know, you hone your skill, the better caller that you are, the better elk caller, the better sounds that you can make. You don't have to hike as far because you can bring them elk to you instead of having to go walk them out and get them. And there is a lot of truth to that. I would joke around with Rocky all the time with that, you know, because, you know, older and knees, you know, knee replacements and kind of stuff. I'm like, man, when you call like that, you don't have to go as far after him. So.
Yeah, you don't have to work as hard if you're a better caller. Work smarter, not harder, I guess.
Yes, absolutely.
What are some, like for a guy who's going to go out there for the first time, because a lot of our listeners obviously are going to be Midwest based, and it's potentially, like you said, everybody wants to do it. So
yeah,
what are some things that they should plan for that maybe you would know from all your years of experience that maybe they're not going to find on the forums or on maybe some YouTube video or whatever? Like, what's some advice that you could give them, practical advice that maybe stuff they would miss?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would start, so if it's kind of like, and I'm trying to think of a few things that I've never done in the outdoor world, which is a lot, but something that would be so complex, because elk hunting is very complex. So I would start from the very beginning, from, okay, we got to do our homework and we got to look and see where we want to hunt. What state do we want to hunt? And we need to look into drawings and first of all, how to obtain a tag, right? I mean, the tag game is real now. I mean, it's become very, very popular. So you got to do some homework there. And, a lot of good information out there and of, you know, states and how different states work, because Montana is different than Idaho and Idaho is different than Wyoming and Colorado and, you know, Washington state and all the places that have elk, even with California, we'll throw them in there because they do have some elk.
Yeah.
So obtaining a tag is where you got to first look and start to plan there. And we talked a little bit about that before we jumped on.
Yeah.
Once that's, you know, you know, find out what state you want to hunt. You got to kind of also think about what kind of hunt do you want to have. Are you looking for the old good old videos of, you know, your bugling and bulls in nasty timbered steep and deep country, or do you want more of a flatland spot and stock, get into a timber calling type stuff that are the terrain's not as tough, where you know put on more miles? You really got to take in all those kind of factors, because and what I see and continue to see is people jump right into it feet first and don't do any homework, and the next thing you know, you got some guys and or gals from a different state, a flatlander state, and they end up in the mountains, and it's just not at all what they had expected from terrain and unpreparedness as far as gear, and then, you know, the ultimate stuff that you need to hone your skill and your archery skills, and or, you know, with a rifle, and then your game clothes, accessories, and all that stuff. So there's really a lot to it. So I would start from the very beginning with the basics, and then we can get as advanced as you want. If you had some specific questions, man, I'd be happy to answer them, but because it's such a broad, I mean, there's so much that really goes into it to make it a success, whether success to you is harvesting an animal or not, or just having a quality hunt. You know, everybody has different measures of success. So there's a lot to go into it.
If you guys plant food plots and you don't know who Grandpa Ray Outdoors is, you need to look him up. They specialize in providing the best nutrition for whitetail deer on your property, starting with the soil. They've got a full line of high-quality food plot seed and plant foods with over 14 different food plot blends to choose from. You won't have any trouble finding what you're looking for. They've got fall and spring blends, corn and beans, switchgrass, liquid fertilizer, soil test kits, you name it. When it comes to planting, they've got it. They're not just about selling their products, though. They were started in 2015. John, the owner, has been in the business since 1991. So with that knowledge that he's acquired, he's going to be able to answer any questions you have about what blends would be best for your specific property. That way you can achieve the best results possible. Like us, John and his team don't believe in a cookie-cutter approach to wildlife nutrition. They're going to treat you and your situation individually. We've used tons of their seed on client properties, on our own properties, and the results have always been as good, if not better, than advertised. That's why we partnered with them in the first place. If you want to, go to GrandpaRayOutdoors.com, use the discount code RHOPODCAST, that's all lowercase, no space, and you get 5% off your entire order there. You guys need to go check them out if you care about getting the most bang for your buck when it comes to your food plots. If they're looking at different terrain types, right, like maybe they want to do that flatter terrain hunt where, like you said, maybe they're going into some timber, or if they want that big, steep, you know, like what you see in the videos, is there a difference in approach as far as the calling goes, or is an elk pretty much an elk when you're calling to them? Obviously, you're going to have to pay more attention to thermals and things like that in different kind of terrain, different ways to get to elk, where they might be staying. But is there, as far as the calling, just for right now, is there a difference there, or is it pretty much all the same across the board?
Yeah, excellent question. Nope. Variables, right? Geographic. We talk to, are you hunting an area that has a high bull to cow ratio or a low bull to cow ratio? That's going to affect how much calling and what kind of calling that you do. So, you know, low bull to cow ratio, generally speaking, you know, it's going to be a lot more of the cow calling, you know, measuring, put in some of your bugles, but because it's the whole fight or flight, right? Would you rather fight or do the funner things that bull elk like to do with the cow elk, right? Mm-hmm. But yes, the calling aspect is always, in my opinion, in a lot, obviously, the elk world, you need to have that calling arsenal. Even at the very least, if you're on the flatlander stuff, to where you're spotting stalking, but that bull gets up, catches you on the draw, you need to have that diaphragm in your mouth to stop him, because unlike a turkey where you're not going to stop him,
right?
Elk, 9 times out of 10, you give him just a quick little calf cow call, just your, he's gonna stop, and then that arrow's sent. So great question, partner. Yeah, it changes. Calling elk are vocal. They want to talk. I believe they have to talk, and that's our job out in the field. When they're not fired up, is to get them fired up. So yes, different, totally different dynamics to geographical where you're hunting, and then obviously elk populations. Are there lots of predators? Are they pressured? Yeah, there's a lot of variables, like I say, goes into that.
Yeah. What are some basic calls? So, like, again, turkey hunting, you like your clucks, your purrs. You got your basics, right? And then once you get better and better, you kind of get more advanced. What are just some basic stuff guys should work on? And maybe you can give examples too with your calls there. But what is just some basic stuff that, like, if you're going to go out here and do this, this is what you need to have nailed down at the very minimum.
Well, there you go. And what's great about elk hunting, elk calling in general, you only need three basic calls, okay? Mm-hmm. So you need your external cow-calf call, which is a barrel, and the barrel can be made of plastic, acrylic. We also have machine aluminum, which is one of our heartbreaker. Personal favorite of mine is Steve Chappell, the Trophy Wife, and that's just an external cow call, has a Mylar reed on it, mm-hmm. and it's a biting bull. And all you do is run your lips up the back of it and move forward toward the front, and you're making cow-calf calls. And that is you.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
At the very least, you have to have the external.
Right.
And I'll example that in just 1 second. The other thing that you need is your diaphragm, like your turkey diaphragm. With your elk diaphragm, you're making cow-calf sounds, ester sounds. I mean, there's quite a few different sounds, but the basics are we need to know our cow-calf sound. And you can do that with your external cow call, and you can do that with your diaphragm. And then last but not least, calling-wise, all you need is your bugle tube. Mm-hmm. And so a couple of them I have in front, you know, and I'm partial because I'm, you know, a little baseball sentimental and superstitious guy. You know, I love our Wapiti Whacker. I did kill that giant bull 2 years ago with the bull basher, mm-hmm. Which is one of premium tubes as well. But yeah, we got a variety of an assortment of external cow calls from our diaphragm selection. We have the most SKUs out there in the market, and we do that because our diaphragm with the palate plate is designed to fit your palate plate. We have three different profiles, which is your low, your mid, and your high. Mm-hmm. So we have something in our selection that's going to fit your palate plate, because the whole kicker with a diaphragm is people say, I can't use a diaphragm or a gag reflex. Well, the palate plate is designed to be a little bit closer to the front of your teeth, so you don't have that
right
gag reflex. Flex the tip of that tongue to the bottom of your teeth, and you seal it, and then you make, you know, the air comes from your diaphragm. So those are the three things you need. You need your external cow call, a diaphragm, and your bugle tube. So your external would just be right here, cow calf basic sound. This is the one you need to know. So you're just cow calf right mm-hmm. there. That might be all it takes that day to get that bull going. And, you know, baby elk stuff 101, you get them on a cow call, stay on a cow call, get them on a bugle, stay on a bugle.
Right.
Kind of like you turkey, get more advanced. Once you feel like you can bugle and cow call effectively, the world is yours. You know, go at them, and that's experience and matching the emotion and elk hunting a lot of these is very instinctual. Some great elk teachers out there, and I won't mention any names, but I truly believe that some of them think they know exactly what the elk are saying. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they do or not. I do not. I know what to do when they are saying, if that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
I can't tell you if that bull's talking to me and saying, hey, I want you to meet me down here at the edge of this cut.
Right.
An arrow in me, or a cow saying, oh, you know, I'm not coming this way because I'm not hearing what I want to hear. I don't know if we can get that crazy saying we know exactly what they're saying, but I can have a pretty dang good idea of what to do when I hear it and what to send back to them, because mm-hmm. experience is gold. I've been able to do a lot. So diaphragm, let's get back to just this diaphragm real quick. So this is with a diaphragm feel in my mouth, the palate plate. This one I have here is the Boss. It's a new Steve Chappell series. Single latex diaphragm, super user friendly, easy to use, and I love it. So you just, same deal, same cow-calf. right there. Mm-hmm. Outcast calls your diaphragm. You take your diaphragm, it's your bugle tube. The bugle you need to know is just your locator bugle. We can get, you know, very advanced and moving on, and we jump on again after the season and say, hey, let's recap how the season went. We talk about some chuckles.
Yeah.
But this is just a quick little hit the high note, right? You don't even have to have influx in your voice. Start from the growl, you know, typical cow call. You're going to be high to low. Bugles, you're low to high. But you just want to be able to hit this note with your bugle, and you're going to get them bulls fired up. Right there.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's cool. So that's like a baseline for guys.
That's baseline.
Nice.
Yeah, and that's right there. You can go and make the basic sounds, and you've, number one, find elk to hunt. You're going to have some fun.
Yeah. That's one question I was going to ask. Also, you kind of just hit on there, was you're using your bugle as a locator more often. And then, like, you personally will, I'm sure you kind of maybe go back and forth, but most often are you locating with the bugle, and then as they get in, you're switching to your cow stuff and kind of finishing them off with that? Or is it just a mixture, or is it whatever the bull's telling you need to do?
See, I love doing these talks in the podcast with the guys that have and gals that have never done it before, because you guys ask the best questions. once again, it's variables of where you're hunting, but no, not necessarily. Yes, you can locate with a bugle. I like to bugle. I like to hear myself bugle. I've worked very hard at it, so I bugle a lot. I will bugle a lot. But that's not to say I start my sequences off wherever I'm at with just a cow call, soft cow call, because that bull may be 100 yards there, and you let a ripping bugle. But he hears that soft cow call. Let's start with our sequence from a cow call to a louder cow call to our bugle, and then our bugle chuckles. So no, a lot of times it'll just be straight cow call and he's fired up and that's all it takes. Or, you know, nothing's going on. And with my bugle, I'd say 50-50. That's why you want to, like we talked about, hone that skill and get as efficient with both of them as you can. So, yeah. I mean, that's.
When you're starting out in the morning or whatever it is, and like you said, maybe you start with just that cow call to see, because if he's 100 yards away, you don't want to just blow him up right off the bat. Are you, you're calling and then, like, you're given a certain period of time, you wait and to hear him? What's that period of time there after you call? Will you sit and wait for either an answer or just to hear something moving, I guess?
Yep. That's another, like, a general, I can give you a general answer because it depends.
Yeah.
Do I know elk in the area or not? That's a big one. Is it something new I've never hunted? So I haven't had a chance to put boots on the ground and see the sign in there, or is it a place I've hunted a lot, many times before, and or I know I have intel that there's elk in there? Because you can do what is cold calling. Go in there and you're making cow calf sounds and like bugles and just hang out, right? Mm-hmm. And next thing you know, go up, come in silent. Might not be that peak part of the rut yet, so they're not real vocal yet. And if it's that, I'm going to spend a little bit more time in that area. If I'm trying to locate, I'm calling, and I'm a very aggressive caller and an aggressive type guy that I need to hear you. I'm an elk hop. If I'm not hearing elk, I'm giving those calls max 10, 15 minutes in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to keep on going. And through the area, you know, you're not calling, you know, like every 2 minutes or something like that. You know, you're giving yourself some distance and making sure that your cow calls are getting into those drainages or your bugles are going across that prairie loud enough to where they would be able to hear you. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's enough of calling. Your sound amplifies much different in the deep, dark timber than it does out on the prairie.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, 10 to 15 minutes in there. If it's a new place, if I know there's elk in there, heck man, I've sat in places and cold call for up to just an hour.
Yeah.
Or even, and then all of a sudden here they come.
Yeah. So that makes sense. Cause we forget that this a lot of times when we're in the woods, no matter what we're hunting, I think, is that they do not have a watch. They're not on time, right? It's just whenever they feel like getting up and doing something is when they're going to do it. It doesn't necessarily have to be by our time. If you guys are looking for your own piece of ground to manage and hunt, Rodney Hawkins is a guy you need to talk to. He grew up hunting and fishing in Southern Illinois, and he's now putting that love for the outdoors into selling recreational properties as a land specialist with Midwest Farm and Land. Midwest Farm and Land isn't your average real estate company. They do residential properties, but they also do a ton of recreational property sales as well. Rodney himself sold over $7 million worth of properties last year alone. They've got agents like him all over Illinois, so they're really a local company with a national reach. For more info on them, what might be available, or even getting your property listed if you're looking to get rid of one and maybe get into something else, you can contact Rodney directly at 618-925-3153, and he'll get you taken care of. He's also got his own company called RG Outdoors that currently has products from Radix Hunting, Tacticam Trail Cameras, Camo Dust, and he's adding new stuff all the time. So if you're interested in any of that, go over to their Facebook page, RG Outdoors. Email them at rgoutdoors@yahoo.com. Or again, just call Rodney directly at 618-925-3153.
A thing that I've used in all over the West is a place that, you know, if I know there were elk in there or had success before, it's almost like, you know, you prime them bull moose. I don't know if you've ever been able to hunt moose, but moose are about as slow as animal in the world to come in.
Yeah.
I'm not case. I've done that a lot. I'd say in the last 10 years with elk going in there, nothing's going on, but I know they're hearing me, you know, everything's sounding good. It's projecting. I'm like, I cannot believe there's not something in here.
Mm-hmm.
I'll get right back next day, next morning, and bam, there they are. They were there hearing it. They just weren't in that range to want to be vocal or pipe up. So
mm-hmm. We actually see that a little bit whitetail hunting too. So just quick kind of story. Last year I shot a buck, and me and the guy that were filming me, one of our guys, we waited in the stand probably an hour, and we got down and went and looked for first blood. Well, while we were looking at first blood, a buck walked through some brush 50 yards away, maybe, didn't see us, so we tucked up into a little patch of brush and called at him, right? We shook some trees, we grunted at him, snort wheeze and stuff like that, and like, it was quiet, so I knew he could hear us. But there was no response, nothing. And I knew he was still right there because we heard him walk in and make a scrape and stop, and we didn't hear anything walk out. So, like, I knew he could hear us, but we waited there for, it was probably 15 or 20 minutes, and we thought, well, maybe he's not coming. Maybe he moved off. We didn't hear him. We're going to walk off and track this buck that I shot. And we did that. We ended up getting to a fence row, so we turned around and came back. All that happened within the next probably half hour, and then on our way back in the truck, we went to get some lunch, and then we were going to come back after that, get permission from the landowner to track the buck, whatever. I got a picture an hour later of that buck coming right across the food plot directly to where we were calling from. Like, I think it just took him that long to finish what he was wanting to do and decide he was going to come check that call out.
Yep. Absolutely. And same with working a bull in the timber up on a hillside. You can, you know, I've had quite a few times where I was able to watch them in some more open stuff, nothing. And then I'm not kidding you, after it's been up to 3 hours of just calling sparingly at him, nope, picks his head up and coming right down the mountain. So,
yeah,
it's just get him to that mindset where, okay, I have to go check it out now.
Yeah. Have you ever had, because it always amazes me that a 250, 300 pound deer can walk through the timber sometimes and not make a single sound, and you just turn around and there they are. Do you ever have that experience with bulls, or are they just so loud?
You are absolutely spot on right there. It's unbelievable how 750, 800 pound, 6-point bull elk can get within 15 yards of you in any terrain, even without great cover, and you turn to your left and have no idea, and he's staring there and looking at you. It's happened to every elk huntress in the woods if you've ever elk hunted. And if people say it hasn't, then they weren't even into elk at all, because it does. It continues, and it will happen. It'll happen to me, myself, probably this year, absolutely. But yes, it's amazing.
Yeah, I'm always amazed at, because it's, you think you're making so much noise walking in, like maybe it's a dry day, you're walking through leaves in the timber or brush or whatever, and then that thing slips up on you, and then bam, there they are. You're not ready for it. Like, they're just staring at you. It's not a great feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk about the archery part just a little bit. What is your kind of thought process with your shot on an elk? Are you, like, because on whitetails, we're, like, I'm wanting to get tight to that shoulder, especially, I mean, like, broadside, right? If it's quartering, we're going to adjust. But are you, if he's just perfect broadside, are you thinking tight to that shoulder? Are you coming off of it just a little bit because they are so big and you have more lungs to hit? Like,
Absolutely. So we talked, you know, that crease tight to that shoulder. Well, elk have big shoulders and even bigger, tougher shoulder bones. So anywhere, anywhere near that shoulder, it's not going to be a good day. I back off from that shoulder a bit and then bottom third, right? On elk, that's specifically broadside. And like you said, if they're quartering away, then we adjust a little bit. Quartering too, that gets a little tricky. Elk are big, big animals, but they have big lungs. So you mess up and you just, you know, quartering two, you get that one lung, they can go forever. And that's how a lot of bulls and elk in general are lost from just quality shots or knowing the anatomy and then, I mean, obviously just a poor shot on a big animal like that. So yeah, I stay off that shoulder just a bit. And then, that bottom third is where it seems, you know, you get in that boiler room and, you know, an arrow will do the job and more efficiently, in my opinion, a better job than a bullet will if it's well placed. I mean, it absolutely, it devastates them. So, yeah, that's where I'm at. Stay away from that shoulder on an elk.
Yeah. I've heard before, some people talk about it with whitetails, you kind of split them into thirds from front to back, and elk, you kind of split them in half, right? Does that make sense? Is that like, does that hold true, you think?
It makes a lot of sense. Yes, back and not too far back, even though, you know, if you do get too far back, there's some saving grace on, you know, because you have that liver that's laying in there, which depending the kicker with elk, though, if you hit them, you need to have that sharp broadhead because you need to have blood trail. It's very tough in all terrain, especially in the steep and deep timber stuff. If you're not getting blood, but you know that shot's fatal, man, it can be super, super, super tough. So that's, you know, I always emphasize a real, real sharp broadhead, cut on contact type broadhead. I know there's the big canicles versus fixed broadheads. I'm a proponent of both. I know that if I have a well-placed shot, I'm going to be just fine. And that's why I shoot my bow a lot, and stuff like that. Cause and sometimes it's just the way she goes. It's not often you have seen, I've been a part of it where I've actually watched bulls get an arrow, not many times, but you know, what she thought's a really good shot, a pinwheel shot, and somehow they can live longer than you would like them to. I'm thankful for both those bulls that, as a part of that, but they are a tough, tough animal. So you want to make absolutely sure, like you said, you're taking a good quality shot.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your setup a little bit there, your archery setup. So from bow to arrow to broadhead, what are you running?
So I've shot Matthews for a lot of years. Great company, been very, very good to myself and our team, and I've had a lot of luck with them. All of the high bows, all bows in general, they are very good. There's some really good bow manufacturers out there, but I'm currently shooting the Matthews Lift, and I shoot that at 70 pounds. My arrow I'm running is an Easton Access, the 5mm. I love those guys at Easton as well. And my arrow weight is right in that 440-ish.
Okay.
You know, for elk, you got to be 400 and above, in my opinion. That's a general rule, though, but that's, you know, because you want to have, you know, the best controllable speed for you, but you also want to have that FOC, you know, in the front of that arrow there so you can smack them good. And so my broadhead, I currently run Grim Reapers, and I've shot both the fixed and the mechanicals, the inch and 3/8 mechanical, the Pro Series. Man, it's been devastating. And when I switched from fixed broadheads to mechanicals on elk was in 2017. I still thought I could play some basketball, I guess. And I went to California on a work function and tore my distal bicep.
Nice.
Yeah. So, and this was 3 months before preseason. So I was devastated. Well, I was fortunate to rehab back, you know, 5 days a week. I did everything I needed to do, and I was able to get some 60-pound limbs on my Matthews bows. And pull, well, I'm very finicky on tuning broadheads and doing all that fun stuff, and just did not have the time. And so it was suggested on these Trident Scream Reapers. And so I did, and I shot a couple, and they flew like darts. And I'm like, well, here we go. Well, I go out, I make not the best shot in the world on a big 6-point bowl, big 30-ish type timber bowl. Let him a little bit forward, a little high, and that broad hit absolutely devastated him, and I was sold ever since. And knock on wood, it's been very, very, very good broad hit for my setup since 2017. So
nice.
That's what I run.
This sounds pretty similar to my setup out here, actually. 70 pounds. I'm like between 450 and 470, probably. I just switched arrows this year, so I haven't measured it out yet. But as far as grains on it, and then I've been back and forth between mechanicals and fixed blades, too. We got some guys that we did a show with recently, Vantage Point Archery. They sent us out some broadheads to try, some fixed blades. So I'm probably going to shoot those this year because I've told – I know it's a big hot topic issue, and like you got to have a hard set opinion one side or the other. You know, that's what everybody thinks. But the people listening to the podcast probably get tired of me saying this, but everybody I talk to that shares kind of the similar opinion, I think. I've shot a lot of different types of broadheads, from mechanicals, fixed blades, three blade, two blade, forward deploying, rear deploying, whatever it is. I've killed deer with about all of them, and I've lost deer with about all of them. So I am not the person that's going to have like the hard, fast, hot take opinion on broadheads or anything like that. I think it's more of find something that you're confident in, that you're comfortable with, and shoot that.
There you go. And I couldn't agree with you more, because ultimately the number one factor of you harvesting that deer, antelope, elk, whatever it may be with your bow, is going to be shot placement.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we'll be honest here. A dang field point will kill a giant bull elk with the right shot placement.
Yeah.
We're not going to do that, but
right,
you could.
He can be a lot harder to find, most likely, but you could definitely kill him, right?
Yep.
Hey, everybody, I appreciate you tuning in for another episode. If you don't already, go over to Instagram and Facebook and give us a follow at Ridge Hunter Outdoors. We also have a private Facebook group called Ridge Hunter Nation where you guys can have some input on the show. You can ask us questions. You can ask upcoming guests questions. You can tell us who you want us to have on and what you want us to talk about. And on top of all that, just use it as a regular hunting group. Share your stories, your success, pictures, your failures, whatever it is. That's all at Ridge Hunter Nation on Facebook. Our website is ridgehunteroutdoors.com. That's where you're going to find more info on the consulting and management services that we provide. We also have the podcast posted on the website with some other content as well. And we have our merchandise and our food plot seed. And if you find any of that stuff that you want, make sure you use the discount code RHOPOD, that's all caps, no space, and you get 10% off your entire order there. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or anywhere else that lets you do so, make sure you rate and review. That helps us, and give us a follow there too. YouTube, our channel is Ridge Hunter Outdoors. You can subscribe to that, hit the notification bell so you know when everything comes out. The podcast will be posted there, as is our Fall Pursuit show, which we'll have more of coming up next season. You guys can go back and rewatch everything that we did this year. We had 10 episodes on that. We're hopefully going to do some turkey hunting this spring, and of course, we'll have all our off-season content on YouTube as well. So thanks to everybody who already does follow and subscribe. If you don't, make sure you go do that. Now let's get back to the episode. What kind of ranges are you, because I know, like, just for my mule deer hunt, when I went out there, I was practicing farther than I would for a whitetail, because I knew there was potential for, part of that unit was kind of high desert stuff, so I could get into some longer shots, so, like, 60, 65 was about where I would feel comfortable, though. What are you, and maybe it changes for you, I guess, probably depending on where you're at, but what are you normally practicing at, and what are most of your shots on bulls at? And I assume that probably depends on where you're at, too.
Yep. You answer the question for me. No, I always joke around and say I'm a really good shot because, yeah, honestly, in the West, in the timber, I'm shooting bulls typically. They're 30 yards or less, and most of them are top pin. I mean, we're talking in the teens a lot.
Yeah.
So you become a pretty good shot when you get to shoot them that close.
Yeah, right.
The farthest I've ever killed an elk is I shot a cow elk at 62 yards, which mm-hmm. was a bomb for and never killed a bull over 42 yards. So this year, the terrain that I'm hunting is a little bit more open. Might have to take a little bit longer shot. So I've always effectively practiced. I mean, I'll shoot 80 for fun,
mm-hmm.
but I want very confident from 50 in.
Yeah.
That's me is pushing it. I mean, the point of bow hunting and I live for, and as always live for, is that, you know, get them in close, right? How close can we get?
Yeah.
And that's not against the guys and gals that you see right now that are flinging 90, 100 yard bombs at antelope and elk, this, that. I mean, I don't want to get into that. That's just not me. There's a lot that can happen in that kind of range and all that good stuff. And the worst thing in the world that you could do is wound an animal, you know, and if you do it long enough, we've probably all been there and things have happened and a terrible feeling. Yep. So I want to be, I feel very, very 50 and in, I feel very, very confident. And that's also to speak to how good that the equipment is, the products that we use are these days, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you said 50 yards 20 years ago when I first started, I'm like, yeah, not a chance.
Right.
I mean, now 50 is like a chip shot with this stuff. And that's, you know, and that's why a lot of the game is getting harvested, more games getting harvested than ever with you know, sticking a string, because guys and girls, they can fling out there a long ways. So 50 yards is where I want to be. Is that to say that if I have one at 58 or 60 and he has no idea I'm there and everything's perfect, wind's right, can I make that shot? Absolutely, because I practice a lot further than that. Mm-hmm. I'd rather just get them in like real, real close.
Yeah, the reason kind of why I asked too is I think you do see a lot of the stuff on Instagram and whatever it is, TikTok, these guys that are flinging 80 to 100 yard bombs at animals, and then people don't get to see, all they see is the 10-second, 30-second reel of them making that shot, and they don't see how many hours they spend shooting their bow, so they automatically think, well, I have to do that or I can do that, and probably not the case most of the time. You still got to put practice in, and then it's nice to hear someone obviously as successful as you doing it that's still saying like 50 yards and in is like comfort zone, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yep. 50, you know, no, and I appreciate that. And that's, you know, like I said, everyone has their opinions or this and that, you know, the guys that'll practice at 100 and, you know, I've seen guys and gals and social platforms get roasted for shooting that far. And then I've also seen them praised for being able to shoot that far.
Right.
It's a cool thing. But yeah, 50 and in, and if you give me 30 and in, thank you, elk gods, you've blessed me. Gods. And so, yeah, I like them close.
Yeah, you said it too. That's part of the archery hunting, I think, the experience. And that too, once you do hit a certain success level, and obviously there's not as many people out this way that have that level on elk as they may have with a turkey or a whitetail or something to that nature. But once you get to a certain point, you can kind of be a little more picky about how you want to kill them too, because it is, for me at least, it's as much about the experience of doing it as it is the actual trophy at the end of the day. So like,
yes.
I mean, there's times if it's not how I want it to be, or if the day's not the day I want to go where I think the experience would be as good, I may not go hunt, or I might not want to kill them that way. You know what I mean? I guess,
yeah.
I think just for me, it's at least on the deer hunting side of it. Obviously, I don't have that experience with the elk hunting side like you do, but for me on that side of it, I want to kill them how I want to kill them, which is, I mean, I'm going to miss some opportunities because of that, but it's just, I don't know. It's just the way I want
to
do it.
Just this past weekend, I talked to you as I'm getting ready to get out on my actual serious elk hunt, you know, big boy pants. But I went on a quick scouting mission just over the weekend, a real quick trip. And if the big bull would have presented opportunity, probably would I have taken it. But part of that was my effort is not going into those places because it was so hot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And like, that's not the game that I want to play in 95 weather and the harvest bull, then have to figure out how to get him out and worry about all, you know what I mean? It just wasn't, like you said, the way that I want to do it, which is a day like today with not as much rain coming down, but a nice overcast, cooler day, like it's go time. So yeah, no, I respect you 100% for that, and I feel the same way.
Yeah. The experience is such a big part of it to me, because eventually that trophy is going to go on the wall, your mount's going to go on the wall, and it's going to collect dust. And if you just have that and you don't have the experience to go back on and talk about it, then all it is something collecting dust, in my opinion anyway.
Yeah. Yep. There you go.
I've heard, especially like in Montana and grizzly country, that once you down an elk, that obviously can be a concern. how much of a concern is it for you when you're out there? Because I think a lot of people that are coming from, again, out east or back east, that's probably, because, you, again, it's something you see on social media all the time, like the grizzly bear stuff, especially if you follow the right accounts like I do, because sometimes I like to see it, like the Nature is Metal account or whatever. But how much of a concern is that for you when you're out there?
I'm glad that you bring that up. So just recently, my wife and I, we built a home in 2015 up north. And I say that to say this is there's good huckleberry picking up there. And my mother-in-law actually taken my three kiddos up there. This was about 2 months ago now. The day after, a gentleman that used to be our neighbor up there got mauled by a bear. By a female, by a sow with a cub. He had to actually pull his pistol and kill that bear. So you need to be very bear aware, and it's the same with harvesting animals out in bear country. I mean, they are predators. I'd like to say, though, they don't want anything to do with you as much as you don't want to do with them, but I've had a lot of bear encounters, a lot of grizzly encounters. Fortunately, they've all went very good. I've only at one time in my whole outdoor hunting career actually had to shoot a pistol and deter a bear and or just boy bear spray. And that's the thing with elk hunting out west, where there is grizzly bear country, you're gonna find the elk where the grizzlies are at, and that's just how it works. So definitely be a concern and do your homework and be bear aware. It's still, you know, I'm honed in that. I went into the dark and I come out in the dark, and is it spooky and can be spooky? Absolutely. I don't do that as much now with having, you know, with my wife and my three little ones at home. I really don't want to get tore up by a grizzly. But I'm not saying you need to be afraid of them. And guys and gals absolutely deathly afraid of them are, and for good reason. But you show them respect, right? You do the right thing. You show them respect. You take care of your kill properly. You know, you get the carcass away from the guts and all that good stuff, and you make sure your quarters are hanging, all that good stuff. Here you're gonna generally be okay. There are those bad bears, but that's just part of hunting in the west with the grizzlies.
What's the closest you've been to one? Like, was it the one that you had to shoot at or shoot your pistol?
No, that one, she had a cub and a sow, and she kept coming down the hill, and She had made the eye contact with me, but it was too many hay bears into it, and she wasn't moving. So I sent one flying way right of her, which is just the bang enough to get her deterred. And she got to within about 30.
Okay.
But I, within 10 yards, come running by that close to you. That puts the hair on the back of your neck a little bit.
How impressive are they? I mean, because I've never been that close to them. We've been out west, and I've seen them like in parks or whatever, but never been that close to them. They like, this seems like such an impressive animal, though, just huge.
And we have in here in Montana the big silverback one. So we have the ones that look like Volkswagen bugs. Holy giants, and boy, they are massive, and they are powerful, and they are strong. They are an incredible specimen. I've coming home from some of the places in the Swan Valley at nighttime. I remember distinctly coming around the corner, and here is a big grizzly, big sow, because I seen her cub with her eating on a deer that had been roadkill. And she, with one paw, took that deer, swung it, you know, 30 feet in the air off that road and took off running. I'm just like, holy smoke. So they're impressive.
Yeah. Let's look forward a little bit here. We talked about it a little bit before we jumped on, but why don't you tell everybody what you got coming up? I know you're excited. You mentioned your scouting trip a little bit, but you got this hunt coming up. Give us a little bit of the lowdown on that.
I got a, you know, my Montana tag here, which fortunate as a resident, I get to hunt elk every year. And that's kind of the other joke. A good friend of mine in Arizona, and he just brought this up. It was just several years ago, and talked to me about all the elk hunting I can do. Like, I'm with you, just talking elk hunt, this and this and that, because I've been able to do it all, experience a lot. And he looks at me and goes, you probably get to be a pretty good elk hunter when you're passionate about it, and it's you, and you get to do it a lot. And I'm like, you said it perfectly, man. I've been able to experience a lot, and that's why we can talk all day, every day, 365 days a year about elk hunting, because I've been very blessed and fortunate to be able to do it a lot. So I can speak to a lot of experience, which is like you talk, it's easy when you've been there and done that. Have I done it all? Absolutely not. And they're going to trick me again this year, like they do every year.
Right.
But we get something figured out. But yeah, got my Montana tag here. Super excited about, you know, an opportunity to find a good bull, which any bull is a good bull, but, going to get after that here. Was supposed to be taken off tonight, but the weather is hampered, and in that country, when the rain comes, you stay out of it for a bit. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be delayed a little bit, but after that, you know, we got some of our other partners with Outsider.com and Sam Mackey, Jay Cutler are coming into Montana, and I'm going to go run around with them and do some calling and have a good time with those guys. And then last but not least, I have an Idaho archery tag that I'm going to hit at the tail end of September if all goes as planned. So busy schedule, but I'm very rarely am I out of cell service or Wi-Fi for the computer more than a day or two, because that's just duty calls. And mm-hmm. in my position with calls, you know, you gotta stay on top of things, and so, which is fine as well. But that's what September looks like. It's going to be busy, and then you know, I'll come back and forth home sparingly. In between that, it's kind of my long part of a couple weeks here coming up, and then get back in October and get back to work and probably sleep for a couple days and hopefully have some good stories and we can jump back on and debrief on the season. So it's about real busy, and it's really starting. Yeah. Tonight.
Nice. Nice. So tell people where they can find you, where they can keep up with you, where they can find the Rocky Mountain Hunting Calls, whatever you want to, just let them know.
Yep. RockyMountainHuntingCalls.com is our website. Jump on there for any of your game call accessories and or needs. If you need to contact customer service for anything, go right ahead. Please do that. We have the best customer service in the world. I can tell you that. Another joke of mine is because that is myself and Tom at the warehouse. So we will get right back with you on all your needs and or questions there. You know, Rocky Mountain Hunting Calls, we have our YouTube page, my personal social. Instagram is just Josh Fields 21, and then Facebook Josh Fields. I'm easy to find. You'll see the beard and in the long hair there, mm-hmm. and a bunch of pictures of animals and some family stuff. Absolutely. So that's where we're at. Yeah, check us out. Like I said, you need anything, jump on the website, and all our contact information is there, and we'll get you set up.
There you go. Well, man, I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule, because like you said, it's about to be. I know this is a busy time of year for you guys, you elk hunters out there. So I really appreciate you taking the time. It was a great conversation, and we will for sure do this again towards the end of the season or something. We'll do this again for sure.
Well, I appreciate you reaching out, and all you've done today is just get me more super excited to get out in the field and chase some bulls and something. These things, something always sparks something. So I'm sitting here, we're talking about elk stuff. Like, oh yeah, scenarios, situations, calling. So no, I look forward to a great conversation, and you let me know when you want to do this again, and if you need anything at all, and Rocky Mountain Hunting Calls, be happy to help.
Awesome, man. Thank you.